This is an ABC podcast.
Tala for Lover and welcome to Pacific Beat. I'm Talia Olatia and happy Friday. Today on the program, in a new strategy announced today, Pacific countries, Timor Leste and Indonesia will be the Australian government's top priority when it comes to aid. Australia's Minister for International Development and the Pacific, Alex Hawke, will join the program shortly. And NRL is back. A record television audience of 300 million sports star viewers from around the world are expected to watch the eight-game return of the 2020 NRL season, which kicked off last night when the Eels made easy work of the Brisbane Broncos. One person itching to get back out on the field is PNG's Justin Olam, who'll line up for the Melbourne Storm against the Canberra Raiders tomorrow.
So I'm just going to go and do my job and play through my strengths, and that's pretty much it. You know, Melbourne is a club where they don't ask so much from you, but they just want you to do your job, so it makes my job easier.
But next, what's going on with fishery observers? The people who monitor ships for illegal fishing and labour practices have been dying and disappearing under suspicious circumstances.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
The sister of an Ikirabas fishing observer who died at sea says fisheries authorities failed to protect him. Eritara Ati Kairua died in March while aboard a Taiwanese vessel. His passing marks the fifth death or disappearance of a fisheries observer in the Pacific since 2015, according to the Association of Professional Observers. Advocates and family members are calling for reform and say more must be done to safeguard those who help protect our oceans. Priyanka Srinivasan with this report.
I was disappointed and sad that I've lost my brother. No matter how much in compensation or in insurance that they'll give, it would not replace the daddy that his children would call him. That money would not replace my brother.
Nikora Kairua is the oldest sister of Eritara Ati Kairua. He died in March while working as a fisheries observer, employed by the Kiribati government. He was on board a Taiwanese flagged ship, Winfar No. 636, that had been fishing in Nauru waters. It's been reported that Kiribati police are investigating his death. Nikora says that she is still grieving for the sudden loss of her brother.
He was very close to me, my best childhood.
Nikora's brother is just the latest fisheries observer to die or disappear while at sea. Observers are employed by their country's governments to monitor ships that enter into their waters, to ensure they don't fish over their limits and hunt protected species. The Association of Professional Observers believe at least eight other fisheries observers have gone missing or been killed since 2015 while doing their job on ships across the globe. Four have been Pacific Islanders. Pacific Beats made repeated requests for details on the investigation into Eritara Ati Kairua's death, but have not yet had a response. For Nikora, though, she's of the opinion that her brother's death was avoidable.
If any accident happens, it means that something has gone wrong somewhere. When there's illegal fishing, there's one observer there with no means of communication. Then it's really, really in danger and at very high risk.
Taiwan's fishing agency has said that it immediately alerted regional fisheries and Ikirabas authorities of Eritara Ati Kairua's death. It says it has provided CCTV recordings, reports, logbooks, and photos of the scene to Ikirabas officials and is cooperating with investigations. But the mysterious death has again highlighted some of the main issues the industry faces. According to the Pacific Islands Forum Fisheries Agency, or FFA, Pacific governments lose more than $500 million in revenue each year to illegal fishing. But there's a human cost too. Observers are said to put their own lives at risk to monitor fishing out on the high seas. Manu Taparosen is Director General of the FFA. It is assisting Kiribati with investigations into Eritara's death.
FFA's assistance entails information and technical and legal advice to support an investigation. For example, the analysis of the data that we hold, such as the vessel monitoring system tracks.
And more broadly, she says steps have been taken to improve the safety of observers. The FFA's 17 members have adopted a set of minimum standards that aim to protect observers.
If an observer is missing from a vessel, that there would be a 72-hour search. It also includes ensuring that an observer is equipped with a two-way device life-saving beacon, an inflatable life vest, and that there be an emergency action plan in place to ensure that the responsibilities are clear for the flag state involved, for the vessel operator, and also for the observer provider.
But some in the industry fear these protections aren't adequate.
Clearly wasn't enough because we're in a position where we have yet another observer that's perished at sea under suspicious circumstances.
Bubba Cook is from the Worldwide Fund for Nature, or WWF. He manages its Western and Central Pacific tuna program.
There needs to be additional work done to ensure that this doesn't happen in the future. It's happened far too often in the past, and it's just not enough to say, oh, well, it's just another tragedy and wasn't preventable, because it is preventable.
He says the nature of their work, keeping an eye on possible illegal activity, puts fisheries observers in a very vulnerable position.
And so anything that they see, for instance, interactions with endangered species or disposal of trash at sea, they have an obligation and a responsibility to document when those instances occur. And it creates a bit of difficulty at times between the owners and operators of the vessel and the observer, because the observer very often is seen as at best a nuisance and at worst a threat.
For now, though, during COVID-19, Pacific observers have been withdrawn from ships to try to prevent the disease from spreading. Government officers will instead use satellite trackers to monitor ships, and they'll only board ships that aren't authorized to be in certain areas. For the FFA's Director General, Manu Toporosan, that makes this an ideal time to review the safety protocols around the observer program.
Observer safety and their health is a priority, a high priority for our members. And so this is an area that we are continually looking at, even during this COVID-19 pandemic. So in the short term, there are several programs calling for the repatriation of their observers. But looking long term, beyond the COVID-19 pandemic, it is an opportune time to revisit how we utilize our observers to ensure their safety and to sustain their livelihoods.
And you called it an opportune moment. So do you hope, why is there a need for human observers to be on board, I guess, in any situation if during the pandemic there's calls to repatriate them? Could there be a potential where we don't need human observers at all considering these risks?
That's a great question, Priyanka, and it's a policy decision for our members. But certainly the global pandemic has made us sit back and reflect on how we utilize best our observers, how we ensure that they are safe, and how we ensure that their incomes are sustained, whether they are at land, on land or at sea.
The WWF's Bubba Cook, though, is calling for tougher reforms so that ships associated with missing or murdered observers are completely barred from fishing.
Basically blacklisting a vessel. If you lose an observer at sea and it's under suspicious circumstances, then you never operate in that region again.
Meanwhile, for Nikora Kaierua, she just hopes other families won't have to endure the loss that she and others already feel.
Justice will prevail. And the families that have lost their loved ones, I'm pretty sure they're waiting on this case to reveal something, to make sure to get justice, because this justice that my brother would get or would win at the end of this fight, that's victory for them too.
That was Nikora Kaierua, sister of Eritara Kaierua, who died at sea while working as a fisheries observer. Pacific Beat has reached out to the Kiribati Police and the Taiwanese Fishing Agency for more information about the investigation. We're still waiting for those responses.
You're listening to ABC Radio Australia.
So, was the latest mission justified? Was it accomplished, as President Trump boasts? And what's the end game? What do the U.S.
Federal parliamentary inquiry found that cyberbullying is now so prevalent it needs to be treated as a public health issue.
ABC Radio Australia.
But they're actually real people. They drink beer and they eat pizza, and they often tell you they don't like exercise.
For interesting discussions,
I asked him why he's chosen to look at human belief and spirituality at a science festival
with interesting people.
Science ultimately speaks to all of human experience. We are all these biological contraptions that emerge from evolution.
ABC Radio Australia.
How do you work with the wet season?
Interesting people.
If you plan for it, it will rain. If you don't plan for it, it won't rain. So we keep pretty flexible in the wet season.
This is ABC Radio Australia.
This is ABC Radio Australia. You're listening to Talia Olatia, because that's my name. Now, we're waiting on the Minister for International Affairs in the Pacific, Alex Hawke, to ring in. So while we wait, let's play a little bit of music. This is a song that you can actually be a part of, because we're putting the call out for a virtual Pacific choir. The ABC's international development team wants as many people across the region and the Pacific here in Australia to be a part of it. So all you have to do is go to the ABC Radio Australia Facebook page. There's a post where it will tell you how you can record your video to be a part of this virtual choir. The song that you'll be singing is Three Little Birds by Bob Marley and the Wailers. Yes, I could play you the Bob Marley version right now, but you know, that's a high standard and we want to make it achievable. So here's the Maroon 5 version. No shade, Adam Levine. This is Three Little Birds by Maroon 5. That was the Maroon 5 version of the Bob Marley and the Wailers classic hit Three Little Birds. And like I said, you can head on over to the ABC Radio Australia Facebook page to find out the details about how you can be a part of our Pacific choir.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
The spread of COVID-19 will dwarf Australia's aid resources and force a rethink of how to help and maintain a strategic presence in the Asia-Pacific region. That's according to a new Australian government strategy that's being released today. And for more, here's Catherine Grau.
Thanks, Talia. Yes, having reviewed its spending, Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade is today setting out a new approach for its development assistance over the next 2 years. Pacific countries, Timor-Leste and also Indonesia are to be the top priority of this new strategy, and it will rely on the government redirecting existing funding so it can focus on health, security, stability and economic recovery in the region. Australia's Minister for International Development and the Pacific, Alex Hawke, joins us now. Good morning, Minister.
Good morning, Catherine.
Now, Minister, the fast redirection of this financial help to deal with COVID-19, particularly for Pacific nations, has been welcomed. But why does it have to come at the expense of other aid programs?
Well, look, the way we've reprioritised money, and you're right to point to it, we've had about 80 requests since January for this urgent reprioritisation, is when you think about what's happened with COVID, we have programs that can no longer go ahead, for example, which rely on travel or movement of people or people in countries. We've got programs that rely on private sector investment or capital being available, which may no longer be available. We've got many programs now that it just makes sense to reprioritise them or change it or grab that money that would otherwise not be spent and quickly spend it on health and other social infrastructure that will make a big difference.
Now, I know Australia's international development NGOs, while they've welcomed this, they also point to the fact, though, that there was a $1 billion reconstruction package that the Australian government created back in 2005 for Indonesia after the Boxing Day tsunami. And they say that's a model of what should be done here because it was new additional money rather than being repurposed because, as also this strategy says, this COVID crisis is going to dwarf the resources you have available. So do you not need to take a new approach and find new additional money given the severity of this crisis?
Well, what we're doing in the Partnerships for Recovery framework is looking at the whole of government effort, and we made a commitment to do that with the International Development Strategy for the first time before the COVID crisis came up. And while some people say, well, the whole of government should have always been the case, usually it has not been the case. And so we've also looked at different bits of money, for example, in my own portfolio where I sit in both the Foreign Affairs portfolio and the Defence portfolios. And in the Defence portfolio, for example, the same case applies. There are programs in Defence in Pacific countries that are not able to go ahead. We're able to repurpose that money and actually spend it through our Foreign Affairs posts in useful and meaningful outcomes with our partner countries in this crisis. So we're looking across the whole of government for money. There's no doubt about it. You're right to say it'll stretch government resources. That's the case around the world where all government resources are going to be stretched by this crisis. You've seen in New Zealand, they're repurposing money in their budget. They're doing the same thing that we are doing. This is the way governments will respond.
Will you, though, need to, when the Australian government hands down its entire budget in October, see aid budget be increased, or the aid budget increased then?
Well, this is a decision for the Expenditure Review Committee and the Cabinet. All areas of government spending will be looked at, as they always are, and those processes are underway.
Now, this new strategy has been released, as we've said, overnight, and it's revealed some things that we already confirmed last week here at the ABC, that the government's going to be taking $100 million from the existing aid programs. And what you're going to be doing is giving it directly to governments in 10 different Pacific countries so they can use it in their own budgets. Now, this is something that Australian governments have historically been very reluctant to do before. So why do you feel that the need to take that step now?
Well, I'll make it clear again, we work very closely with partner countries. We have bilateral programs, we have regional programs within the development budget, and all of those matters are now being looked at in our country plans. So, with the crisis, you have to understand, with 80 requests since January, these requests, we've assessed each one of them very carefully. They've been urgent, they've been necessary, they've been about health security, economic security. And we assess that in the coming months, when you think about sectors like tourism, for example, being completely closed, in the case of Fiji, that will be half of the country's GDP. So, we assess countries are going to need budget support more than ever before. So we're prepared to look at that through reasonable prisms. Of course, you'll have Australian standards, Australian safeguards. We'll have oversight and we'll work very closely with our partner countries as we develop those country programs. And, if you think things have changed here in Australia, all of our partner countries in development, their priorities are going to shift again, and we have to be very responsive to them.
This direct budget support, though, how long might it last? Is this still a short-term plan and something that you hope will be able to be scaled back in a year or two?
Well, we'll be able to speak to more to that as our bilateral program is developed with partner countries. You can imagine that will be different depending on the temperature within different countries. As this crisis moves, you've got very different circumstances in some places and, in Southeast Asia to some element areas of the Pacific, and we'll announce those things as they develop.
Now, Minister, to some other topics. Firstly, an audit into the multi-million dollar contracts for security and cleaning services at offshore detention processing centres in Manus Island and PNG was released yesterday. The company at the centre had been quite controversial, known as Paladin. Now, this audit has found that while the management of these contracts was, quote, largely appropriate, it did certainly criticise some of the processes, such as the fact the government hadn't demonstrated value for money in these contracts, and also that five key staff who were involved in the awarding of these contracts had not filled out a conflict of interest form. So there are some serious issues there that have been highlighted.
Yeah, well, all of those matters are matters for the Department of Home Affairs and the Minister for Home Affairs. I'll leave those questions to him and them to answer them. Obviously, it's not my department, and I wasn't in this portfolio while those contracts are being arranged.
No, but it does speak to the way that the Australian government has made decisions about deals and contracts in the Pacific, in PNG, and clearly you had to act quickly at that time, and as you are now as well with this new strategy being released today. I mean, are measures in place to ensure that proper processes will be followed?
Well, again, you're best to direct that to the relevant minister in relation to the Paladin contracts and home affairs. That isn't my department. We obviously, with the international development budget, put in place very world-leading standards in relation to safeguards. There's a performance matrix there, and we've put that out for the sector to have a look at. And again, we think the standards are very high about getting value for money out of the development budget.
All right. To another matter, this week you declared a new $17 million initiative that the government is going to be paying over 3 years, providing Pacific broadcasters with Australian TV shows for free. You said it was a terrific demonstration of shared cultural ties and links between Australia and the Pacific. But as has been pointed out by critics this week, it's not really about sharing. It's very one-sided. Existing TV shows that have been made for Australian audiences are simply being given away to free Pacific broadcasters who already have admitted that they struggle to pay for TV shows themselves.
Yeah, well, look, I'd encourage people not to be critical of these sorts of initiatives in a macro sense. The government is investing in capacity in terms of broadcasting in the Pacific. And look, we don't have any embarrassment about broadcasting Australian content into the Pacific. I think it's good quality content, and there's a demand there. Audience in the Pacific like to see what's going on in Australia. We like to see what's going on in the Pacific. And I'd say to you, it's not the end of the story, and the government will be working very closely. We're certainly partnering with more media organisations. We're certainly speaking with commercial providers, ABC management, everyone to see how can the media and our entire journalism profession step up as well, and how can the government facilitate that?
We say it's not the end of the story, and certainly the two heads of the PNG TV stations involved told me that their preference would be to have co-productions with Australian and Pacific or PNG broadcasters so that they could build up skills, but also see Pacific television shows on Australian TV. So it really is a two-way thing. Is that something and those preferences going to be listened to?
Yeah, no doubt about that. And we're certainly going to listen to them about that, and over time we'll make those investments and those announcements. I think there is a really important mission for everyone involved in the media, including a public broadcaster, to ensure the Pacific stories are told within Australia. I've been a big advocate of it. I mean, I went to Fiji and participated in Q&A, Catherine, and that was fantastic to see a Q&A on Pacific issues in the Pacific, and I commend the ABC for doing that. There's plenty of other good examples where media organisations are stepping up. The government's here to support that. Making sure Australian content is getting into the Pacific is good for both countries, and yes, absolutely, we want to make sure that content is produced within the Pacific and returned to Australia as well.
Now, perhaps what might be a little bit more interesting for listeners, you've already talked about tourism and the difficulties faced in countries like Pacific. Now, we've had a lot of talk in recent weeks that countries in the Pacific could be included in this travel bubble with Australia and New Zealand. Are we any closer to having a more definitive time frame about when that may happen and which countries as well in the Pacific are going to be part of it?
Yeah, this is a very important concept, and in the statement that the joint Prime Ministers Ardern and Morrison released, they obviously referenced the importance of a Pacific travel bubble in the future, and that we'd be making steps towards it. Now, we have made progress towards the Trans-Tasman bubble, and that is proceeding. These are very difficult and complex issues, and in ways I think people sometimes are still coming to understand. It's not so much with the Pacific travel bubble that we are concerned about the impact of Pacific countries on Australia, but often our Pacific neighbours at the moment are working very hard and have very tight border restrictions that we're supporting in very difficult situations where we are the risk to them. So there's a two-way conversation here to have about the travel bubbles, how they will work, how they'll operate. That needs to be done very carefully, has to be managed very carefully. But of course, you know, you've seen Prime Minister Morrison speak very strongly about the fact that we'd like to see, ideally, Pacific countries added into a travel bubble. But that will be at the country's discretion. It will be after we've had the Trans-Tasman bubble established and working. And there's a lot of work to do on the detail with partner countries.
There's talk, though, that the New Zealand bubble, for example, could be up and running or starting as soon as July. I mean, is it likely that it could be countries like Fiji, you know, included as soon as August?
Well, we'd like to see everything up and running as quickly as possible. What we're finding is, you know, with the health advice, with the restrictions, with the practical implementation, it can be more difficult. So we're not putting a timetable on it. But, you know, countries are working as fast as they can to deliver it. I understand the issues in Fiji are critical, and that's why we're reprioritising our budget here with the development budget to support as much as we can in the meantime. And I know both countries, New Zealand and Australia, are working to get our Trans-Tasman bubble working. So then, you know, if we can get to add-ons as quickly as possible, we will.
Just finally, obviously, the other key part, I guess, for Pacific Islands relationships with Australia is the workers that it sends here. The remittances, obviously, highly valuable, and even more so now with these tourism industries decimated. Is Australia looking to, and can you confirm if you will, expand the number of workers who are able to come here? But also, have you been able to guarantee to Pacific governments who might be worried that their workers might be at risk that that will be addressed?
Yeah, thanks, Catherine. This is a very important question. We have already provided the certainty for the workers here in Australia, and we've given them an extra year extension, as you and your listeners know, up to a year with their visa arrangements. We've made sure they're supported here, I've been on the phones to employers making sure there's immense support provided to Pacific workers who are here in Australia. Before COVID, we had immense plans to expand the numbers from many, many Pacific countries, and we still want to see that occur. It is much more challenging in the COVID environment, as I said, not because of our desire, but because of the new restrictions with various countries and implementation issues. Now, the government, of course, this is an area where we can, regardless of travel bubble questions, work very hard with partner countries to see the flow of Pacific labour still coming to Australia. We're going to be working closely with our counterparts in the region, and we would like to see the ability for Pacific workers to come here and remit their money back home, and that great story of providing great benefit back home and to the workers, and here a supply of labour to our own farmers continue. So we're certainly working very hard on that.
All right, we'll leave it there. Alex Hawke, the Minister for Pacific and International Development, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Catherine.
Now, for more detail on that new aid strategy of the Australian government, you can head to the ABC News website or ABC Radio Australia's Facebook page, where we've shared the story.
Radio Australia now has a WhatsApp. Just add +61437519385 to your phone. It means you can message Radio Australia from anywhere in the Pacific. So add +61437519385 and send us a message. Tell us what you want to hear and join the conversations on Radio Australia.
You're listening to Pacific Beat. My name is Talia Olatia. Time for a weather update. And to do that, I'm joined by Neville Coop, the director of Nandraki Weather. Neville, good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Talia.
Neville, how's it looking out there today?
Yeah, look, it's another one of these groundhog days where we wake up to weather pretty much identical to that we've seen over recent days. There's not much change, as we've said before. The weather pattern is very slow moving at the moment, and there's some some good reasons for that, which are a little bit complicated, so we won't go into the detail, but suffice to say, there is a frontal system now moving south of Australia, and that's going to finally clear away this sort of blockage in the system that's been slowing things down, and probably by next week we'll start to see a return to the regular cycle of weather. But until then, weather's pretty good, right across the South Pacific. Mm-hmm. About the only place that has any weather this morning is Samoa, and elsewhere most of the major population centres are fine, bright and sunny, especially around Vanuatu and New Caledonia, where they've been enjoying lovely weather in the last week or so.
And it's going to stay like that for the weekend as well, Neville?
Yes, I think it will. I don't think this front's going to get here in time to change much in the next few days, but Monday, of course, is the 1st of June, the first official day of winter, and that'll probably be the day that we start really seeing the weather pattern start to change again as the big high pressures that have been blocking everything in recent days start to clear away and we get some fronts through.
Indeed. Have you got anything planned for the weekend, Neville?
I'm going to enjoy a bit of nice weather, perhaps at first here in South Australia tomorrow, but after that the wheels come off pretty quick. And then over the weekend, just again catching up with my family, and which is largely the reason I'm still here in Australia, and spending a bit of time with them while I can.
Yeah, well, sounds good. Have a happy and safe weekend, Neville, and we'll catch you next week.
Thanks, you too, and we'll talk on the first day of winter.
Indeed. That was Neville Coop there. He's the director of Nandraki Weather. And for weather updates at any time, you can always visit their Facebook page. You'll find them at Nandraki Weather. Nandraki is spelt N-A-D-R-A-K-I. Let's find out the stories making news across the region and around the world as well. And to do that, I'm joined by Priyanka Srinivasan. Good morning, Priyanka.
Good morning, Talia.
Now, first up, the PNG Prime Minister has come out with an official statement saying he has nothing to hide. What could he have been hiding that he is not hiding?
Yes, that's right. I guess we should call this generator gate or something like that, because it relates to the purchase of two generators from Israel back in 2013 for a cost of nearly 22 million Australian dollars. So as we heard earlier this week on Pacific Beat, the Prime Minister James Marape's former, or his predecessor, I guess, Peter O'Neill, was arrested and charged last weekend as he returned from Australia to Papua New Guinea. He was charged with misappropriation, official corruption and abuse of office, as he was PM when these generators were actually bought back in 2013. So the police allege Mr. O'Neill directed payments without following procurement processes. My gosh, that's a
but basically, a tongue twister.
Yes, exactly. The processes needed to buy these generators. Now, another Papua New Guinean NP, that's Beldin Namas, has requested police arrest everyone who is involved in the deal. Everyone, including current Prime Minister Marape, who is Finance Minister at this time. So that's why Marape has issued this statement, as you said, saying that he has nothing to hide. And he also said he won't stop police from arresting him if it does come to that. So something to watch.
Yeah, sounds like there'll be a lot more coming out of that story of Generator Gate.
Yes. And we'll turned it.
Yeah, it's now official. And we'll be sure to bring you the updates here on ABC Radio Australia. Priyanka, in other news, one of the world's smallest elections is happening this weekend.
Yes, smallest elections in tiny Niue. So that country has a total of 1,168 people, to be exact, who have registered to vote in 2020. So that number is actually more than the number of voters back in 2017, more than 49 voters, again, to be exact. So they'll head to the polls on May 30th. That's Sunday for us here in Australia, but they're a day behind. And the issues on voters' minds will include the government's performance and transparency of the government. You perhaps don't know this, but the most recent audit report tabled in Parliament is for the financial year 2014 and 2015. So just a bit old. So the last 5 years are still pending. So along with that, TV Niue is also reporting that campaigning has really been happening Pacific style. There have been campaign signboards nailed to coconut trees. And candidates are going door to door. I mean, there's not too many of them, about 1,000 people, to go to electors to hand out flyers, you know, sort of campaigning for people to vote to them. But there are reports that people are just randomly picking candidates out of a hat to vote for. So.
Oh. Yeah. See, if I had a big family and I lived in Niue, lots of family, lots of friends, I was like, hey, guys, I'm running. Surely all you'd have to do is have a good chunk and you'd be in with such a small 1,168 people.
Yeah, you'd imagine you'd know each one
exactly.
of the candidates.
I think you'd take related. It pretty personally if someone didn't yeah, vote for you.
Exactly.
They're like, well, you're not getting a cup of sugar anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting one. And like you said, the election will happen Sunday Australian time, so we'll have more on the program on Monday to hear about the results, because I don't imagine it will take very long to count that many results. One of the joys of being in such a small country to have an election, you don't have to wait for days for people to count your results.
Exactly.
Finally, Priyanka, live rugby is back in Australia as of last night, which is good news, and it's good news on the PNG front too.
Yeah, that's right. So PNG's rugby league got the green light by the country's COVID-19 team, the state of controller there. They are allowed to hold one domestic competition, but under this sort of revised model. So new conditions have to be met. And those conditions include two things. First, there has to be a detailed protocol on spectator control and detailed training plans for doctors, physios and club medics so that they're able to contain and control the virus. So no date has been set yet, but PNG RFL chairman Sandis Tsaka says operational plans for the 2020 Digicel Cup season will be made known soon. So we can't wait. Really?
I know. As I was saying before, though, like this weekend of the NRL, they were expecting 300 million people from around the world who are so desperate to watch sport that they will watch anything, will tune into the 8 games of this weekend's NRL season. And the games are being played to stadiums where there's no one there. They're editing in crowd noises so it makes it sound a little bit more lively. But that just goes to show how desperate people are for sport. And I'm sure in Papua New Guinea, this announcement just means hope is on the horizon. So it's very good news for rugby fans. Priyanka Srinivasan, thank you for bringing us those stories.
Thank you, Talia Olatia.
Thank you. I did think it was weird that I said your name and then you said it back to me and it just further confirmed it. And we'll have more good news for fans in just a moment because, like I said, the NRL is back as of last night, and you're going to hear from PNG rugby star Justin Olam.
The ABC's expanded FM network now reaches 5 major centres in Papua New Guinea.
On 101.9 FM.
You can now hear us in Port Moresby, Lae, Mount Hagen, Goroka and Arawa Bougainville.
On 101.9 FM.
Keep up to date with regional and international affairs, sports, lifestyle, cultural and environmental stories. ABC Radio Australia on 101.9 FM across PNG.
You're listening to Pacific Beat. My name is Talia Olatia. And like we said, the sporting world here in Australia is starting to come back to life with last night, after a 2-month hiatus, the 2020 NRL's season resuming with the Parramatta Eels recording a comfortable win over the Brisbane Broncos. The final score was 34-6. And while no fans were allowed to attend to the game, the television broadcast still included some virtual crowd noise. Here's what it sounded like on TV when Fiji and Maiko Siva scored a try.
A metre away, Marnie, Moses, Brown, cuts out Gutherson, goes to Jennings, short ball, for the corner, spectacular!
Surely not. How has he scored this? Or has he?
Have a try.
Got a try.
Touchline, touch and goal, mate.
He is one of the great try-scoring wingers of the modern era.
Now, audibly, that sounds the same as most sport. I think visually it would have looked very, very different. Tomorrow, Melbourne Storm will line up against the Canberra Raiders with Papua New Guinea star Justin Olam in their ranks. On the back of the breakout season in 2019, the PNG international has just signed a new contract tying him to the Storm until the end of the 2022 season. And speaking to Richard Ewart, Olam says he's raring to go after so long away from the action.
This bloke is a headline every week. Justin's got another one. He's the hero of so many kids at the moment across PNG.
I'd love to say that about myself. If I influence one young Papua New Guinean to, you know, believe in himself and, you know, follow his dreams, that'll really mean a lot to me because that's why I play.
Back to the left. Just an over.
I presume, from your point of view, the fact that the season has been delayed for this long must have been so frustrating. So what has the training routine been like for you over the last couple of months?
Most of the time I was just training on my own at home, like with my brother here. So we were just training together just a little bit sometimes. And yeah, pretty much that's it. And then the last 3 weeks was just back into training. So yeah, we got the most of it the last 3 weeks.
I assume although you were training on your own, you would have been getting guidance from the physios at the Storm.
Yeah, definitely. They drew us like a training program. They gave us, you know, things to do during the break. So we're basically doing those things, but, you know, at least give time for our body to recover as well. That's pretty much it.
So where would you say that you're at physically going into the restart of the season as compared to where you were at the start of the season proper, if I can put it that way?
I feel good. I've been working very hard the last 3 weeks, which is good. I try to do extra some things that I feel like I need to improve on. We had a very good preseason and we thought we were going to at least go good in the season, but then, you know, the COVID happened. So, you know, I'll try to do the finishing touches and see where I'm at. And then after the first game, I obviously will know what I need to improve on.
Back to the left. Just an over.
How much contact have you had with your teammates during the lockdown? I mean, have you been able to sort of get together online and have a bit of a chat and maybe a bit of a virtual party or something like that?
Oh, yeah. We always have a chat like once a week with the boys and on the house party. And they're like, you know, just to talk to see where everyone's at. Yeah, I always call my friends and my close friends and to see how they're doing, especially my best friend, Tui. So, yeah, it's pretty much like we're not alone. You know, at least we're talking and see if everyone's okay.
And what about friends and family back home in Papua New Guinea? How much contact have you had with them?
Well, I always call them on Facebook Messenger like almost like every second day. So there's nothing wrong with that one. It's been good.
What a tackle. One-on-one. Justin Ollam. Ollam here, reaching out, plants it down.
Was there ever a point where you considered going back to Papua New Guinea? Was that ever an issue for you?
Yeah, no, I wanted to go. But then like my big brother was in Sydney. So I was waiting for him to come down because I didn't want to leave him and go. I don't know how bad the situation going to get with the COVID and that. So I was just going to stay here and wait for him. Even if I go, I don't want him to be alone in the country because it's not our country and we don't know what to do. So if the things get worse.
So there was a decision there that you had to make. You did consider at one point going back to be with the rest of your family.
Yeah, I was going to go. Like, yeah, 6 weeks, you know, off. It's just too much time. It'd be good to spend with my family, especially, you know, tough times like that when you surround yourself with your family. It's a good place to stay, but couldn't do it though.
What were the club saying to you at that point? Because clearly if you had gone back, there would have been quarantine that you would have to go through in Papua New Guinea. And then, of course, how you would get back would be an issue.
Yeah, they allowed some of the boys to go back to their family if they want to, or if they can. But yeah, and obviously, if I come back, I will stay 2 weeks in quarantine, which, you know, most of the boys that went back home and came back, they did. It was not an issue.
Holland with a ball, sizing up Capo. He's gone past him.
And what are you looking forward to when the season resumes? It's going to be strange, obviously, playing in stadiums without fans. But in terms of building your career with Melbourne Storm, you proved last season that you can more than hold your own in the NRL. I mean, you must be pretty excited about what lies ahead for you.
Yeah, definitely. There's nothing I can do out of the box. It's just I'm just going to go and do my job and play through my strengths. And that's pretty much it. You know, Melbourne is a club where they don't ask much from you, but they just want you to do your job, so it makes my job easier.
Hello, here's Ollam. Oh, he's away from one, away from another. Look at this! He's got on the right side, and Ollam's away this time, holding on.
And to get where you are now with the Storm, I mean, you've had to work pretty hard. Of course, you came through with the PNG Hunters and then arrived with the Storm, but then spent quite some time with the Sunshine Coast team in the same competition as the Hunters, the Queensland Cup. I mean, you've had to work hard, haven't you, to get to where you are?
It is hard because I only started playing when I was 18, and, you know, to come here is different because we come from PNG and, you know, we had to learn a lot of things here, not only on the field but also off the field as well, you know, to adjust to the living style and everything like that. So yeah, the first 2 years was hard for me because we had to travel all the way to Queensland every day before the game, play and come back and train with the first group. Yeah, I had to learn, you know, to adjust to the situation and do my best.
And I'm presuming you feel pretty comfortable, do you, at the Storm and living in Melbourne? Melbourne?
Yeah, I made some good friends here, good memories, you know, good place, good city living.
So I guess your other ambition, as well as continuing to build your career with the Storm, will be to get back in a Kumuls jersey and see what impact they can make when the next World Cup comes around in 2021.
Yeah, definitely. We have a few Kumuls boys coming out. You know, there's two boys coming and training in trial for NRL, and some few boys are playing, you know, they got exported to play for Queensland Cup, and then so it's just good. They'll bring their experience back, and hopefully we can do better at the World Cup.
Working left, deft kick throw. Look who's there! Look who's there! This time it's Justin Olam.
Look who's there, indeed, and no doubt there'll be a huge wave of support for Justin Olam from the lounge rooms of Papua New Guinea when he steps onto the field with the Storm tomorrow, looking to build on his breakthrough NRL season in 2019. And Justin was in conversation there with Richard Hewitt.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Let's squeeze in a little bit of music. This is another song. Of course, it's another song. That's what music is. But it is Reconciliation Week this week. So this is a song from Lou Bennett and the Millennium Choir. This is Inanna. The beautiful voices of the Millennium Choir, joined by Lou Bennett there with a song, Inanna. You're listening to Pacific Beat. Fiji's Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama recently announced that schools that have been closed since March will not open until the country is COVID-19 free, putting a huge question mark on when students and teachers can return. While the Ministry of Education is providing students learning materials so that they can learn from home, many students and their families say they are struggling. Two teachers, Anna Kubunakoro and Ilasoni Ratusai from Study Point Tuition, are offering tutoring services for these children. But they don't expect to get paid, with cash at least. They're using the now extremely popular Facebook page Barter for a Better Nandi, which is one of the several pages hoping to support Fijians impacted by job losses caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. Ilasoni Ratusai says bartering for tutoring has seen some tasty deals, and he spoke with reporter Marla Damati.
Tutoring business was something I hadn't planned for, like, in my life, because I was a law graduate. I joined in English teaching back in 2013. So after I was teaching, then I realized that I needed, like, there was, when I compared my teaching and then helping out kids at home, there's a total difference, because it is sort of, they were lacking what the basic fundamental concepts in English compared to the international students I was teaching. So I was thinking there's a big gap in public school the English curriculum.
And have many students and parents reach out to you and to Study Point Tuition Centre to get lessons?
Yes, I started the centre. Actually, Study Point is made up of two centres. Mine is Study Point, and the other tuition centre is called 7 AM. So because of this pandemic, we both, like both directors from the both different tuition centers, decided to collaborate.
Now, talking of the COVID-19 pandemic, it is quite a difficult time. You know, schools in Fiji have been closed since March. Why did you decide to offer your services on Fiji Barter for Better?
I just recently opened up. I'm also administrator for the Barter for Better Mandy page. So after I was seeing there was a couple of posts of people offering their tutoring services with Barter, like maybe like every single teachers who had teaching experience. So, and also on the other hand, I felt like there were parents who were not reluctant to bring their kids over to the center because they thought, like our existing parents, like they thought it was still expensive for them to send over because most parents were unemployed. But then, come to think of it, when I saw deep onto the mechanism of the barter system, and then Teacher Anna and I, my business partner and I, decided to try it otherwise. Maybe in this case, we'll be reaching out for parents even at the very vulnerable states, like those, the unfortunate ones, those who cannot afford to have to bring over their children. They can even use that mechanism of barter to actually, you know, use it as a platform to bring education closer to their doorsteps.
So being able to access tutoring for their children in exchange of goods and services, the community must have been really excited at this prospect.
They are very excited. And what we're surprised about is that enrollments are just, you know, they're just drowning in every single day. So when I finish up in a day, I get like 10 to 15 friend requests on Facebook, and all of them are just parents who are interested to bring over their children, and they're willing to barter anything at all. Not only with goods and services, you just said, my friend, it was not only, like we were even surprised. Like we weren't expecting that much of, you know, of things from the students. So what we told them is that we encourage them not actually to bring out the value of the prices of the tuition that we are charging, but anything at all. So what, even a parent came and brought seafood and even root crops of that sort and even baked goodies. And today we got in a parent who made roti and curry, just lunch for the teachers. That was something, you know, we could see that the initiative was counted so much how they wanted the children to come and learn phonics and how to read here at the center.
You know, as a teacher, how important is it to you for students to be able to access this education, you know, especially not being able to go to physical school, being able to have tutoring sessions and have this opportunity?
To me as a teacher, not only as a teacher, but to me as a third party between parents and the education system, I feel that we play a vital role. We stand in for parents. When they're at work, we stand in for the schools when the schools are closed. I feel like it is important that we provide these services because these are the only chances that they can get their own focus group, the study groups, then studying in bigger numbers. So this also encourages them, like to develop quickly, more comparatively to the local schools.
Now, during this global pandemic, you know, as a tutor yourself, do you worry that maybe some students might fall behind because they aren't able to do the work they need to do in their home setting or that are struggling and don't have access to tuition like you are offering? Is there a worry that some students might be behind when school does eventually open back up?
There is certainly a lot of worries. I was getting, like, after I had advertised on Barter for Better Nandi page, I was surprised that many parents were messaging me and asking and sharing with me their problems and their concerns at home. Like they feel most of the children are really laid back, laid behind with with regards to worksheets, and you know, because they don't have time to actually get feedback from the teacher. They don't have time to go to school and ask teachers and instruct them on what exactly they should do with their worksheet. And many of them have been really having problems with their notes coverage during the school break. And we're trying to reach out to these families for them to come over, and even though they don't have to pay for anything, they don't have to barter for anything, as long as they know they're on the same wavelength as other students on their level, as long as no one is affected, no one is left behind.
What advice or what message would you like to give the students and teachers in Fiji at the moment who are maybe feeling a little bit unsure of what their future will look like in terms of when school will get back? What message would you like to give them?
I've always been telling myself that, you know, for teachers, like people who play behind the scenes of education, we need to be grateful of the opportunity that we have now, that we get to stay home, but maybe we can, you know, expedite our skills on people who really need it. Like for some, most students, they feel lost. They feel vulnerable at state right now. So my advice to children who don't know that third parties like us, avenues like us, they can seek for help. Their parents can use media platforms and other resources to actually communicate their needs and their problems to us so that we can come and visit them. I mean, in that way, when we work in collaboration with the parents and with the community, and we network with other people, because in Fiji, it's easier to network around with many, many people around you in society, regardless of your ethnicity and your racial background. It's easier to always communicate to other people. So we can use these mechanisms to actually, you know, see somebody who's suffering and offer your help and your services to them as well.
That was Marla Damati there speaking to Fijian tutor and teacher Ilisoni Ratusai. That is all for Pacific Beat for this morning. Don't forget that Richard Ewart will be along at 3 p.m. PNG time for the afternoon edition of Pacific Beat. So keep listening to ABC Radio Australia. A big thank you to the team, Priyanka Srinivasan, Catherine Grau, Jordan Fennell, Marla Damati, Richard Ewart, Evan Wasuka, Liam Fox and Anthony Stewart for all their work this week, as well as our technical team as well, Jules, Chrissy, Brendan, Ari and Gareth. It takes a lot of people to put this program together. And thank you to you for your company. I hope you and your family have a happy and a safe weekend, and we'll catch you tomorrow, Monday, for more Pacific Beat.